Wisconsin. It is the Maggie Dawn Show. I am Maggie Dawn, joined as ever and always by my wonderful producer, Brian Kelly. But because it is 3 o'clock, it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires talking money as we do every day in the 3 o'clock hour. Set your schedules, folks. You're not going to want to miss a bit of it, especially my wonderful, kind guest today. Her name is Sarah Anderson. She directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is the co-editor of the IPS website, inequality.org. Sarah's research covers areas like inequality, obviously, CEO pay, taxes, labor, and Wall Street reform. She's the lead author of more than 20 annual executive excess reports that have received extensive media coverage. She's also written a couple of books because she's a very smart woman, including The Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. She holds a master's in international affairs from American University and a BA in journalism, no less, from Northwestern. So you'll know a little bit about what we're doing here. Welcome so much, Sarah. It's really special to have you here. This week in particular, having kicked off the week with Labor Day, of course. You know a lot about executive compensation, and your organization just came out with an absolutely stunning report. Tell us about this, because everybody's known that CEOs get paid a lot, but it's become a lot more, and it seems to be accelerating, does it not?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Maggie. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm originally from Minnesota, so sort of next door to Wisconsin. And I've always found that when I go home to the rural community where I grew up, I can find common ground with people on CEO pay, no matter where they are on the political spectrum or whatnot. I think people find it just so outrageous that there are these extreme gaps today between CEO and pay for CEO pay and pay for ordinary workers. And the report that we just released zeroes in on the 100 largest low-wage companies in America. So we're talking about Walmart, Home Depot, McDonald's, Starbucks, Dollar General. I could go on and on, but many companies that your listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar with. And one thing we found is that the gap between average CEO pay and worker pay at these companies last year stood at 538 to 1. In other words, a typical worker at these companies would have to work 538 years to earn as much as the average CEO at these companies earns in 1 year. And, you know, a lot of these companies like to say, well, we don't have enough money to pay workers a living wage. But the truth is they have plenty of money. They're just focused on making those at the top even richer. And so another really important part of the report, I think, is that we looked at how much these companies have been spending on stock buybacks.
Yes.
This is where a company repurchases their own shares. And when they do that, it artificially inflates the value of their stock. And that in turn inflates the value of their CEO's stock-based pay. And so stock buybacks are really a scam to make executives and shareholders even richer. And this group of 100 low-wage companies spent over $500 billion on stock buybacks over the past 5 years. So that's just one, you know, outrageous example of the very perverse priorities of these companies that are so focused on making people at the top even richer, while many workers are struggling even to put food on the table.
We had a great guest last week. I'm going to blank on his name, Brian, if you can remind me, who talked about stock buybacks. That's all we talked about what a scam they are. The fact that they didn't exist into a little known securities provision was inserted into the federal code in, I believe, 1982. And so we've seen these. Yeah. Yeah. And I just wanted to be sure that everyone, just to highlight the statistic you mentioned, these 100 low wage companies, again, companies like Starbucks, Home Depot, Dollar General, et cetera, that they've executed stock buybacks exceeding $1 trillion. What was the exact statistic and how much?
Over half a trillion dollars.
Over half a trillion.
Stock buybacks over the past 5 years. And one thing that is just such a huge number to wrap people's minds around, but I think that the thing I was most shocked by in our report this year was we compared how much these low-wage companies have spent on stock buybacks to all of the money that they've been putting into what you call long-term capital investments, things like technology upgrades or fixing up their stores or, you know, other things that companies have to do to be competitive over the long term. And 47, almost half of the companies on our list had spent more money on stock buybacks to inflate CEO pay than they'd spent in these long-term productive investments.
Wow. So when we're talking about, like we did with our guest last week, the idea that profits for a company can be, quote, plowed back into the company, meaning these technological investment capital improvements, improving the way that their stores look, the customer experience, the online experience, research and development, or of course, in worker wages, or even bonuses. Those are all choices that a company can make. And you said nearly half or just over half of these 100 low-wage companies are spending more on buybacks than even their R&D tech improvements or capital improvements. That's incredible.
Isn't that just insane? I mean, and another way we put this in context is we looked at Lowe's, the home improvement store. They spent the most of any of these companies on stock buybacks over the past 5 years. They spent $43 billion. And to break that down, that would have been enough to give every Lowe's employee a $30,000 bonus every year for the past 5 years. And that would have meant a lot to these workers because their median pay is just $32,000.
Yeah, that statistic, when I read it, Sarah, blew my mind. I'm going to repeat it at the sake of being repetitive here. Lowe's, which employs over 200,000 people, who pays their workers on average below effectively the poverty rate. In other words, what they pay around $33,000 per year isn't enough in not the federal poverty rate, but the real poverty rate, what it costs a single person to live. They pay them less than that. They could have nearly doubled all of these employees' salaries for 5 years, not a single year. Every single one of these over 200,000 in number employees could have nearly doubled their salaries for the amount that Lowe's has spent to enrich their CEO and their shareholders. And their shareholders aren't me and you, regular middle income and working families own an incredibly small, less than 10% slice if we're looking at the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or just companies writ large that are traded publicly on our stock exchanges. That is gross, would be a word for it. Yeah. And here's the thing, Sarah, it hasn't always been this way, has it?
No, and it's really important for people to know that because it's empowering to know that it didn't always used to be this way and we could go back to a different system. So if you go back to the 1960s, the gap between average CEO pay at a big company and typical worker pay was about 25-1. In the 1980s, it might have grown a little bit to like 40-1, but nowadays it's more like 300-1 for the S&P 500. And why did that happen? I mean, one reason is there was a tax reform in the 90s that allowed companies to deduct as much as they wanted off of their federal income taxes for CEO pay that was so-called performance-based, in other words, tied to the value of the stock price. And what that meant was that the more they paid their CEO, the less they owed Uncle Sam in the form of taxes. So it was just this gusher of pay going to CEOs. And often the company boards are made up of CEOs or executives of other companies.
They're so buddies.
They're scratching each other's back, you know, and keeping this insane system in place, a system that makes no sense to pretty much anybody else in the country.
The interesting thing here is I think the average American, and certainly I believe in what I like to call aligned incentives, as someone who's got an economics degree who cares deeply about public policy, I like to see aligned incentives, right? Where workers do better and maybe the CEO does get paid more. But what happened here was not just a performance incentive, which sounds good to many of us. Mm-hmm. What happened here was a tax break that sort of looks like a performance incentive. And so what you've created are really perverse incentives for CEOs to engage in financial manipulations, things like stock buybacks, to temporarily juice stock prices to get their big payouts. And a lot of boards of directors, even those that have good governance models with lots of independent directors, they don't object to this because they get this newfangled tax deduction on their corporate taxes. It's a bad incentive that works well for everybody but the frontline worker. My special guest this half hour is Sarah Anderson. She is the director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is the co-editor of the IPS website inequality.org. Because it's 3 o'clock, it is Maggie and the Millionaire. She might not be one, but we're talking about those millionaires because it is so important to each and every one of us. I always like to know how I might be getting screwed personally. And this is one of those ways. You're not going to want to go anywhere, anybody, because I'm back with Sarah after these brief messages. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. It is the 3 o'clock hour, and that means here on the Maggie Dawn Show, you're going to be listening to me and a terrific guest talking about money, because it is always about the money, money, money. And I personally like to know when workers in the middle class are getting, frankly, for lack of a better word, really thrown under the bus in favor of billionaires, millionaires, and CEOs. My special guest this half hour, Sarah Anderson, she directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she knows all about out-of-control, runaway CEO pay. Thanks so much for making time, Sarah. You just laid out some statistics right before we took a break that in the 60s, the CEO-to-worker pay ratio was around 25 to 1. By the 80s, it had crept up to 40 to 1. Now, we're looking at a staggering 300 to 1, largely because we created perverse incentives in the tax code for corporations to engage in things like stock buybacks and for corporations to use things like innocuous sounding CEO performance-based pay. But all of this has created a system where workers come last on the list of priorities, it seems, for corporations when they're choosing what to do with their profits. How does it affect on what's going on in our politics right now? Is it showing up there too?
Absolutely. I think the reason I've kept working on this issue so long and what gives me hope is to know that there is so much common ground among Americans across the political spectrum in terms of the outrage over excessive CEO pay and wanting to narrow these gaps between CEO and worker pay. And all the polling is showing that. And we also saw how this played into like the very high profile strike of the big three automaker workers last year. Polls showed that Americans agreed with the workers that it was crazy that CEO pay had gone up so much faster at those automakers than it worker pay had gone up. And I think that public support helped push those companies to the bargaining table and help get those workers new fair contracts. And I think that candidates, I would not be surprised at all if candidates are hearing about this outrage as they're going around to the state fairs and doing all their electioneering this year leading up to November 5th. And the good news is there are a lot of policy solutions that they could be working on. We do have a new stock buybacks tax. It's very low, but there's interest in quadrupling that tax. That was in the DNC platform. I thought that was interesting. And there, I think there should be some cross-partisan support for things like that. There are also ideas about making companies pay a higher tax rate if they insist on having these extreme gaps between CEO and worker pay. There's also the idea of making companies that have huge gaps between their CEO and worker pay pay a higher tax rate. And we could also be doing more to use the leverage we have over corporations that are getting public investment funds through government contracts and subsidies, and in using that to pressure them to narrow their gaps, which many would argue would be better for business and the bottom line anyway, because companies that have extreme gaps tend to have lower employee morale and higher turnover. And so if that would be a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, you started to talk a little bit about some of these metrics of performance and employee morale and all those things. I want to get back to that because I think there's a real interesting cultural phenomenon going on here. But I do want to echo your sentiment, Sarah, that I think every voter, if this matters to each and every one of us, someone we know or care about has likely worked for one of these companies. Most of us will spend some portion of our career working in the private sector. Understanding how executive compensation works, especially at these high levels, is essential. And I think it's a completely fair question for any voter to diligence and ask candidates, what is your position on CEO pay? What is your position on stock buybacks? What is your position on wealth taxes? All of these things matter. And when we're talking about this CEO pay problem, the runaway train that this has become, you mentioned a few things that I think merit emphasis. Higher tax rates on corporations that insist on having CEO to worker pay ratios that are simply at off the charts, right? At the highest levels of disparity. We've talked about thinking about asking the federal government and other governments to at minimum have companies that contract with them report out those ratios and try to create some incentive for those companies to pay their workers more. Other solutions I've heard, again, a straight up buyback ban. That was Ken Lozanik's viewpoint. It buybacks taxed at 1% now, not why not 4%? Why not 20%? These are simply cash grabs that billionaires and those that control hedge funds are engaging in. We can talk about ESOPs and worker ownership of companies so that workers actually reap some of the return. We can talk about workers on boards of directors, those that set CEO pay, at least in publicly traded companies. There's a lot. There, taxing wealth, just like we tax work, all of these things would be good. But one thing that concerns me, and I was a business school graduate, is that many of my friends that work in corporate leadership, many of my friends, others that they know, those that teach corporate leadership, business leadership at our most elite institutions, we draw from a small pool when we're talking about CEOs. They hire their friends and buddies to be on the boards of directors. Is there a serious cultural problem amongst our country's most elite business schools? Is there just a bad set of expectations from corporate leaders that they should just be paid more and more?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. There's this old tired argument that they have to pay these massive salaries to get the top talent, and that these guys in the corner office are really worth hundreds of times more than other workers who obviously all contribute to the value of a corporation. And I mentioned that the gap between CEO and worker pay used to be around 25 to 1. Now it's 300 to 1. There is no evidence that that change has anything to do with the quality of managerial performance at the top. This is about greed. This is about a set of elite people looking out for each other's interests and not thinking about the long-term prosperity of their workforce, their communities, and even their own companies. Because one business school study after another has shown that if you have narrower gaps, people feel more like they're part of a team. It brings out the best in all of the employees, and companies can be more profitable. So we do have to change the culture and show that nobody's worth 500 times more than another worker who's adding value to that company. And there are some practical things we can do to narrow those gaps.
My special guest this half hour, Sarah Anderson, directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute of Polity Studies. Check out her work at inequality.org. One last fact to share with everyone. Ross Stores has both the lowest median worker wage and the widest pay gap. This from your report just blew my mind away. In 2023, Ross's CEO hauled in $8.1 million, which is 2,100 times their average median employee's wage at $8,618. Disgusting. The last thing I'll say about changing the culture of folks coming out of our top flight B schools, it would also help if we weren't just hiring a whole bunch of old white dudes, eh, Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah, they're making a big deal about 10% of S&P 500 CEOs are women. That means 90% are still men.
Are mostly old white dudes. Thanks so much, Sarah. Folks, you can hear Maggie and the Millionaires every day at 3 o'clock. Keep it locked. More coming up here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thanks to my very fancy producer, Brian Kelly, who has pulled together for us this half hour some really extraordinary clips from some pretty famous Republicans talking about women. You know, I always like to learn about myself by listening to a Republican man describing my role in the universe, culture, politics, and our economy.
Maggie, the important thing is that you don't, Maggie, you don't understand it being a woman, is that you need a really strong Republican man to explain it to you. That way you can be edified. I mean, this is how all knowledge is formed, by Republican men giving it to us.
Yes, giving it to women especially. Just as a place setter, folks, I've been talking about J.D. Vance. Every day, it seems, there's another weird thing he says. I want to take a listen to the most recently unearthed weird thing. And then we're going to listen to Wisconsin's own Derek Van Orden saying more weird stuff about women. They are very eerily similar because this is the worldview of today's MAGA cult. Ladies, you have legs to go from the bedroom to the kitchen and back. That is your function. You don't need to do anything else. And if you dare to do anything else, you're going to be miserable. Just ask J.D. Vance.
And so those people end up focusing on career and on credential at the expense of the things that actually make people happy. And so you have people at Yale Law School, you have women who think that truly the liberationist path is to spend 90 hours a week working in a cubicle at McKinsey instead of starting a family and having children. And I think that those people, in their defense, they genuinely believe that the path of liberation is to work 90 hours in a cubicle at McKinsey. What they don't realize, and I think some of them do eventually realize it, thank God, is that that is actually a path to misery. And the path to happiness and to fulfillment is something that these institutions are telling people not to do. And that's basically what I think the corruption is. The corruption is it puts people on a career pipeline that causes them to chase things that will make them miserable and unhappy. And so they get in positions of power, and then they project that misery and unhappiness on the rest of society.
But then where does the racial gender resentment come from? Is it just because they realize that they didn't get what they want and now they want to exert their anger on the world? Or
nothing like a good slam on the angry black woman if you can fit it right in there. I mean, what? The path to misery. They're going to business school or law school, JD, not parent classes, for crying out loud. Like, yeah, if you're pursuing a graduate degree, presumptively you want to go do some work somewhere, right? Like, especially at a place like Yale or in business school or in law school, like that is presumptively what people are there for. It's not a parenthood training class. It's not a teach me about the 19, well, basically everything before the 19, I don't know, 80s about gender roles.
Maggie, I don't understand. What is, how is this different for a man than it is for a woman in the same circumstance? That's what I don't understand. That's what he fails to get, any of this.
Talk about it at all.
Are his male classmates doomed to work in a cubicle?
Are you just as miserable if you work? I'd say to JD, listen, I've worked 80 hours. I've worked 90 hours in a week. Everyone that was doing that with me, be they male or female, married or single, with kids or without them, every single one of the people that were working 80 and 90 hours a week with me, trust me, JD, we were all miserable.
Yeah. Or you're so passionate about it, you all work 90 hours a week together. But the point is that it's equally either miserable or wonderful for all genders, because it depends on the project you're working on, or the job you're doing, or what you're working with, and the people.
Yes.
But all of it is, but again, you're going back to the most simplistic stuff. People, these guys haven't really thought through much of their things, and very few people ever push back on it. You know why? Because you're in the Moment of Truth podcast, you know, that hit podcast that nobody listens to? Yeah, that's what happens.
Corruption is, it puts people on a career pipeline that cause them to choose things that make them miserable and unhappy. So that'd be you too, JD, by definition. You're miserable and unhappy because you work and you went to these same corrupt institutions. To use the word corruption to refer to education, which provides people with choice and economic mobility, is disgusting. Coming out of the mouth of a guy bought and paid for by a billionaire, who ran his own fund funded by a billionaire, and who went to one of these elite institutions. So it's good enough for you, JD, but not good enough for women. Okay, cool. I got it. And in case there was any doubt that this is what the MAGA cult thinks about women, that you are vessels for babies and caretakers, and that is it. Why don't we listen to the Mensa member, also known as Derek Van Orten, also known as Congressman Van Orten, also known as the bully that pushed the kid in the library, that cursed out some Senate pages in the rotunda, pushed a lady in a line, and basically says and does really nasty things. Let's listen to Derek Van Orten and his incredibly enlightened thinking on women.
And just so you know, everybody, this is another really famous podcast, the First Class Fatherhood Podcast.
Sir, I find it fascinating that it's sort of in vogue to look back at, you know, we call them primitive cultures, which I think that's a derogatory term, so I don't really use it. But if you look at Aboriginal cultures, there are very, very clearly defined gender roles. The mom is at home with the baby for, you know, the first 6 years of their life. And if you look at the inter-scene, the inter-family violence that takes place in those cultures as compared to Western cultures, it's almost non-existent. If you look at the murder rate, the theft rate, all these things that we track as metrics in our society, in our advanced cultures, we are more inclined to violence in our advanced cultures then we look at these Aboriginal cultures. And I think it's because when you do have the ability to have a mom that's at home, that's taking care of you, we got to remember only females are capable of growing a child and giving birth. So let's just remember that. And they're the only folks that are capable of actually nourishing a child with their body. That's just a fact. And when you grow that bond with the child to the mother and allow the father to do more external things, providing for that mother so that she doesn't have to go to work outside of the village or outside of the home. It allows that bond to grow between the mother and the child, which really humanizes the child more. And then the child can look towards the father that's doing a more traditional provision of sustenance. And it works. I mean, look at these cultures and say, you can't argue that they're not more peaceful than we are.
Oh my goodness.
I've split into two because, Maggie, I'm beside myself. I am here and I'm next to myself.
Dear listener, are you also cleaved in half by the stupidity that is Derek Van Orden? Just to summarize, because women are in the workplace, our culture is more violent. So women need to return to their role as caretaker, let men do the breadwinning and, you know, the external things to provide things like sustenance. And this is the way society should be organized, based on Derek Van Orden's PhD in human anthropology. And no, oh wait, no, no, no.
Maggie,
no,
it's science. Maggie, it's science.
What? As if there's no distinction between some of these different cultures, right? As if
all Aboriginal cultures are the same.
They're the same. Totally peaceful. I wonder if that would come as a surprise to some of those cultures. Bananas. And like, we have invented computers, right? And calculators. Does that mean...
And nuclear weapons and machine guns and
automobiles and the assembly line.
The internet.
Does that mean... Right. Does the interwebs, it's a series of tubes. Al Gore invented it. Does this mean, by Derek Van Orden's logic, that we should just toss all those things out, right? Because we have more violence now, and so those things must be the cause. There's so much there, I can't even
Except for
begin.
If you think about it, even a little bit, you can kind of poke holes in the non-scientific theory that this moron is espousing.
This is the prime example. I think both the Vance statement and this garbage from Van Orden are these statements that really show how, like, every syllable, every word is dog whistly and laden with misleading information. It's a big old fat lie, but it sort of sounds like an opinion that maybe is related to some facts, and it has this veneer of plausibility to it, right? But when you think about it, it's gross. It is oppressive. It's separating people into less equal groups. It's saying some people can do these things and other people, mainly women, should only do these things. And if you don't do that, implicitly you're bad. It's stupid. This is an example of the problem that I think journalists have fact-checking these guys, that journalists have just responding to that. I don't know what I would say to him if he said something like that, other than that's stupid and incorrect, and you should not talk about anthropology because you sound stupid, and I have every right to pursue any career I damn well please. I'm proud to be an American. I'm free, baby. What are you? It would be very hard to interview someone that said something that stupid.
Yeah,
it just would.
And the reason why it works, Maggie, is because the folks who are voting for these people have a very simplistic outlook on things and don't worry about thinking. It's pseudoscience that works for them. These are the people who hate everything to do with masks, regardless of whether it's scientific or not. They hate everything to do with any sort of thing that is inconvenient towards them, which may be even to do with science. Or maybe, hey, don't say that stupid racist thing again. And it's just a pushback on that because these scientists with all their facts are trying to keep us down. So if I do pseudoscience, it maybe seem like the aliens are real and that Bigfoot's just around the corner.
And to a certain extent, they're saying some ridiculous things and making people feel a certain way, I can grant you, is part of politics to an extent. But what I'm trying to point out here is this just isn't stupid, feel-good, base appealing rhetoric. This is rhetoric that says at its root, women are less equal, less capable, not equal at all. They're not equal. They are not capable. They shouldn't be out of the home. That women have one place, and that is childbearing and child rearing. That the thoughts behind this rhetoric isn't just about making the base feel good. It is dangerous, and it has become ever the more dangerous. Just look at what the Supreme Court did in Dobbs, the overturning of Roe. That's what this has been about. And if you had any doubt that conservative MAGA cult men are obsessed with women's sexuality and women's freedom and women's economic freedom, let's just take a quick listen to Jesse Waters talking about what's going to happen if Kamala Harris becomes president and some intense things happen in the Situation Room.
And let's talk about foreign policy. What is her foreign policy? This is where the president has his most impact. You have a lot of room to maneuver there as commander-in-chief. We don't know who she is. We don't know what she believes. She's going to get paralyzed in the Situation Room while the generals have their way with her. Right now,
Jesse,
Jesse, I don't like that.
Figuratively,
take
again,
take it back.
Have their way with her. Control her, not in a sexual way.
Then why did you say that?
And why are they laughing in the background?
That's so
disgusting.
Funny.
Disgusting.
And this comes on the heels of all of the Donald Trump reposts referring to Kamala Harris and that she got where she is because of blowjobs, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is seriously an issue, because it sends a message, a dangerous one. We need to reject this rhetoric. If you're a man that loves a woman, has a daughter, had a mom that you love, a wife that you may love, a partner, say no to this kind of garbage. Trump's foreign policy. Ooh, Putin can do whatever he wants. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Wisconsin. I am Maggie Dawn. He's Brian Kelly, my fabulous producer. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. So we've spent some time. I've been ranting and raving about these basic, it's misogyny, right? Like we have a word for this crap that comes out of J.D. Vance and the likes of Derek Van Orten about women's place being in the home. And I find it, you know, not the least bit ironic that Derek Van Orten is about to be unseated in the 3rd Congressional District by a woman, no less. Go get him, Rebecca Cook. I hope she beats him by double digits, Brian. It would be the only correct result from someone who espouses such drivel and nonsense. But it is not the only local election that pits what I would call a very reasonable Democrat against a Republican that has said absolutely revolting things. There is a young man who is running for the hotly contested 94th Assembly District. This is the 94th Assembly District, so state government here. His name is Ryan Hepsch. Now, if Hepsch's name sounds vaguely familiar to you, that would be because, you know, nepotism is good. It happens a lot in politics. His dad previously held this same assembly seat, and he actually became assembly speaker. His name was Mike Hepsch. He spent 16 years as a Republican in the legislature, and in 2011, under Scott Walker, Mike Hepsch, the dad, began serving as the secretary of the Department of Administration under then-Governor Scott Walker, and he was later appointed to the Public Service Commission, a job he stepped down from in 2020. His dad's been in politics and, you know, working off the public dime forever. Now his son wanting to take over the reins from dear old dad. Now, to set the table even further, Mike Hepsch, back in 2001, called Tim Carpenter a gay slur on the Senate floor and actually had to apologize for this. Yeah. This was back in, 2001. Then Representative Mike Hepsch, the dad, called Tim Carpenter on the mics in a debate, in a floor debate, a gay slur, had to apologize. So like father, like son, this apple has not fallen far from the tree. Ryan Hepsch has had some really disturbing posts on Twitter. So this is the son now. In 2014, the post was kind of confusing. It was a meme. It involved the black rapper Tyler, the Creator. So Tyler, the Creator, is wearing a green baseball cap that says the word golf on it. And next to him in the meme has been superimposed a golf ball wearing a green hat with a racial slur on it. Very nice. This is what Ryan Hepsch puts back out there. And he responds to it and amplifies it by saying, I need a hat for my balls. Very nice. Then comes his a Facebook post from 2010. This is him with a rifle at a military base. And he says, can't wait to kill some blank. And it is an ethnic slur for people of Arab descent. And then he posts this. LOL, that was racist. Sorry, everyone, but I'm joining the Marines. So just saying. By the way, Hepsch never joined the Marines, never served. So that was false. If you know it's racist, just a little tip for Ryan, probably don't post that. He's also used the term retarded numerous times in tweets, including one in 2013 that said the B-I blankety blank blank word. You just went full retarded.
It's a tropical, it's a movie reference, but again, you really shouldn't be making that, especially if you're going to be doing anything political later on. Actually, anything at all. You probably shouldn't say that at all.
Yeah. And like, keep in mind, this is his dad is very active in GOP politics. This was all during this time. This would have been known, right? He's now 28. He's running again. This is in the 94th Assembly District. If that is where you are, take note, because he's running against Democratic Rep. Steve Doyle of Onalaska. So it's up in that area in western Wisconsin. He's apologized. He said, oh, I did this when I was young and stupid. I never said anything like that when I was young and stupid. Never, never did. Not in private, not to a friend, certainly not on social media. But to me, this is kind of, if the culture of your party is one of racism and bigotry and otherizing people and telling women they have no business in the workplace or politics or anywhere that's cutthroat, like, isn't this what you end up with? I just, to everybody out there, like, this should not be acceptable from any candidate. Can we go back to when things were, I want to make America normal again, Brian, where we used to universally say, saying racist things, bad, and if you do, you don't get to be an elected official. Is that too much to ask?
Well, Maggie, I don't know if you've ever seen a movie from the 80s, but I watched a couple over the weekend.
Yeah, they don't age well.
They do not age well. There's a...
We should do a whole show about that. Like, which segments from which films do you think have aged the most awkwardly?
Hey, Darby, why don't you come and watch this movie? It's,
Never mind.
Let's not. There's a couple Darby things in here.
Is, of course, Brian's beautiful daughter, yep, who is amazing. How old is she now?
She... First day of school today, she's a seventh grader, she's 12. And
oh my goodness.
By the way, she's taller than Amy and she's up to my chin. I'm 6'5" and she's at my chin right now. You know where this ends, Maggie.
Yes, on a rugby field, winning a national championship for sure. I have a number of rugby balls. Anytime she'd like to learn the scrum formation, just hit me up. That's Fancy Bryant Kelly. His daughter is the amazing and tall 12-year-old Darby, who just started school yesterday. Happy first day of school, Darby. Maybe a day late, but certainly not a dollar short. That's going to do it for us this Wednesday, everybody. As always, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But remember, it is better when we stand together.